Welcome to Your Turn, Mike Causey. Delighted to have you with us, as always. And we're going to have a really good, multifaceted show today. I know I say that almost every week, but as they say on Bullwinkle, this time for sure. My guests are Sean Riley from the Federal Times. He's a senior writer. I've been with them for quite a while. And Tammy Flanagan, who I guess is known to many, many people in the federal community. She is the ultimate benefits guru, and she's the person that developed the best day to retire scenario, which is one of the most popular features now. I pick it up from her every year, and we're going to be talking about that. And there's just so much going on. Tammy, are you with us?
I'm here, Mike.
Hey,
good to see you.
Thank you
good
for
to talk to you anyway.
You're right. Thank you for being here. And Sean pointed out that get right into this thing. There's so much going on that could have an impact on federal workers. Nothing in the State of the Union last night, you said, Sean, except for him asking for the power to reorganize government agencies.
That's right. There was no mention, say, as opposed to last year when the president referenced the fact he'd. Already, that he recently imposed a two-year freeze on base federal pay. Talked about seeking a five-year freeze on domestic discretionary spending. Last night, his only reference, and it came pretty far into the speech, was his request a week or so ago for Congress to give the administration "quote unquote" fast track authority. To reorganize, restructure the government.
Well, go back a year, and Tammy, feel free to jump in at any time on this. For more than a year now, federal workers have been, it's been kind of a Perils of the Pauline soap opera. They come to the brink, and then nothing happens. This commission threatens to do things, and nothing happens. This committee threatens to do it. Yet the pedal hits the metal here at some point. On February 29th, this joint congressional House-Senate Republican-Democratic committee is supposed to do what?
Well, they're going to go ahead and, I think, try and come up with some recommendations for finding savings, again, sort of targeted towards deficit reduction and making ends meet. And some of those proposals will have some impact, could have some impact on the federal workforce.
Well, and looking at the laundry list that we believe they're looking at, we think we know. One of them is extending the pay freeze for another year or two or three, requiring federal workers, postal employees and retirees to pay a greater share of their health premiums, and that would mean a lifetime pay cut, if you will.
Sure.
And the amount they'd pay would increase over the years to the point where some have estimated they would wind up paying almost half of their health premiums instead of the 30% they now pay.
Mm-hmm.
Take-home pay reducer would be forcing workers under SERS and FERS to pay more for their benefits. They would move that up considerably. Eliminating the FERS supplement, and that's the amount of money that the government gives employees who retire before age 62 and become eligible for Social Security. That's a big-ticket item for a lot of people. Basing future retirement benefits on the employee's highest five-year average salary. Right now, it's the high three formula, and then switching to a system, I think you called it the chained COLA system,
mm-hmm.
where in the future they would base inflation raises, cost of living adjustments for retirees on using a different yardstick that would be produce lesser raises each year and every year than under the current system. And I'd like you both to comment on this if you would. What intrigues me is most of the heat we get here at Federal News Radio, both by email and by telephone from people, the one that seems to scare people the most is the possible change from the high three to the high five. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there's a debate about how significant the impact would be. I've heard one theory is that it really wouldn't have that significant effect. I'm really interested in hearing what Tammy has to say about this. And that what gets feds up in arms is the fact it's so visible and so easy to calculate, that it's so prominent, but that the actual dollar amount would not, in terms of the impact on annuities, would not be that significant. But Tammy, what's your sense about this?
Well, right before you called, I did a few calculations just to find out for myself, because I've heard the same thing back and forth, and I've done kind of in my mind some general calculations. But I actually sat down and I said, what if I was a GS-12 Step 10 employee? Which is, a little above average for the rest of the country, but maybe about average for D.C. area. And I calculated a high three, I calculated a high five, I calculated what if I'm retiring under FERS, what if I'm retiring under CSRS. And I did it, you know, just to pick a number, I did it for someone with 30 years of service. And what I came up with is if they were a GS-12 Step 10 for the last 5 years, they have had no promotions, no step increases. All they've had was the January pay adjustment in 2008 and 2009 and 2010, and, of course, no pay increase in 11 and 12. And I came up with a monthly difference for the FERS employee of about $45 a month using the high five instead of the high three. And for the CSRS employee with the same service, same salary, their difference, because their annuity calculations more generous, would be about $85 a month. So it's not nothing, because, you know, $85, even $45 a month pays for something. But the real difference is going to be if in the future Congress decides that they can start affording to pay pay increases of 3% to 6% as we've had in the past. Or what if you have an employee who got a major promotion in the last 5 years? And oftentimes when that happens, the employee will decide to work another 3 years to get their high three. So does this now mean that they're going to work another 5 years so that they can get that new promotion salary in their high five? So I think it can have some repercussions besides just the basic calculation. I think, you know, looking ahead to what pay rates might be in the future, and also what the mentality of an employee would be, knowing that they're going to be going back now 5 years to look at your salary.
That's right. It's the old law of unintended consequences. You you legislate one thing, but people react to it quite differently from what you, or maybe people didn't think of it at all. The National Active and Retired Federal Employees, they were kind enough to give me some figures, and they estimated that the average, and I stress average is just that, the average for future FERS retirees, the loss from going from a high three to a high five would be $1,424 for people under the civil service retirement system, and an average of $462 less for people under the FERS retirement system.
That's about right. And the other calculation I did was, what if you did get a promotion? So I had that same employee who went from a GS-11 to a GS-12 over the same 5 years. And even with the promotion, the difference in the FERS employee would be about double what it was before, $104 a month. And then for the CSRS employee, almost $200 a month, having that promotion in that last 5 years, which kind of supports the thing that where I said that somebody who gets that promotion might now decide, I need to work an extra 2 years beyond what I was going to do, you know, if it was a high three scenario. So I think it's just going to make employees rethink when they plan to retire.
And you think they'll hang on longer then, huh?
I do.
Okay.
I see it happening already.
That's interesting. We got an email from John, and he thinks that I have been underplaying the impact of the possible high three to high five. And he said in his case, he says his agency has an alternate pay system. So with performance-based awards to high achievers instead of step increases. I've done the math, and for my FERS pension, were I to retire soon, the difference between high five and high three is $2,248 a year. He said that's more than negligible. And what he's really concerned about is the elimination of the FERS supplement. And he said in that case, that would that's worth about $12,000 a year to him. And if that goes, he would really be up the creek.
Yeah, and I think his example is kind of relative as well, because in my calculations where I'm using a salary just a little under $100,000, you figure to have as big of a difference as he's predicting, you know, he's got a much higher salary. He's also had more pay adjustments, you know, due to those quality step increases or whatever the pay increases he's been getting every year. So I guess a $100 difference for someone making, you know, $90,000 a year might be relative to someone getting a $200 or $300 difference making, you know, $180,000 a year.
Okay, need to take a short break here, and I want to give some phone numbers when we come back if you want to talk to Sean or Tammy.
Experience GW basketball in one of D.C.'s best college venues, the Colonials Club. As a member of the Colonials Club, you will enjoy a game day atmosphere that is unmatched in Washington area college basketball. Your philanthropic donation and loyal support for GW Athletics provides countless opportunities to our student athletes in pursuit of both their academic and athletic goals. Call 202-994-7325 to join the Colonials Club today and help raise high the Buff and Blue.
You download the free application for your iPhone or iPad or Android smartphone, and then you go to their network, and then it knows all of the infrared codes for these things, and it's got the programming for 500 models. And then once you download the specific details for the model of the equipment that you have, this remote control will control everything.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The environmental problems we're facing today are more complex than those of 40 years ago. So what is the EPA doing to better incorporate sustainability into its decision-making? Why is the EPA involved in green chemistry research? Join host Michael Keegan on the next The Business of Government Hour as he explores these questions and much more with Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator, Office of Research and Development with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife. My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
America's top show about planning for retirement is on 1500 AM WFED. Sunday mornings at 8, it's the Financial Safari. Each week, America's income planner, Coach Pete DeRuta, sits down with father-daughter duo from Northern Virginia, retirement planners Don and Jill O'Rourke from O'Rourke Asset Management. Sunday mornings at 8, it's the Financial Safari on 1500 AM WFED.
Hey ladies, I'm Jill Sorensen, Caps beat reporter from Comcast Sportsnet. Want to see hockey from a woman's perspective? Then visit scarletcaps.com to sign up for Club Scarlet for free. Members receive an exclusive newsletter, a chance to win great prizes, and invitations to members-only events, including hockey and heels. Check out scarletcaps.com for the latest blogs and info. To join, log on to scarletcaps.com now.
mHealth has the potential to transform the face of health service delivery across the globe by expanding access, improving quality, and decreasing costs. Tune in to Jane Norris of Fed Central Wednesday, February 1st and 15th at 11:30 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. to learn more about the innovative ways the developing world is using mHealth to bring healthcare to the masses.
Human Capital Management for Defense is a highly anticipated training conference with over 300 delegates and key speakers, such as Lieutenant General Daryl D. Jones, Deputy Chief of Staff for Manpower, Personnel and Services, U.S. Air Force, Honorable Thomas R. Lamont, Assistant Secretary of the Army, Manpower and Reserve Affairs, and Honorable Juan M. Garcia, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Manpower and Reserve Affairs. This year's event will be held on March 12th through the 15th at the Sheraton National Hotel in Arlington. For more info, visit hcmdusa.com. Mention code FNR for a 25% discount.
Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Sean Riley, senior writer for the Federal Times, and Tammy Flanagan is a, I guess, Tammy, you are the senior person at the NITP, the National Institute of Transition Planning.
Yeah, on benefits, that is.
Right, and you you also write a column for Government Exec, among other things, and it's very popular. We all read it, and Tammy is the one that invented or discovered the concept of the best day to retire, and I want to get into that with you in a second. But our telephone number here, if you want to talk to Sean or Tammy or me, is locally 202-465-3080. That's 202-465-3080. And toll free if you're out of the area, 877-936-9333. That's 877-936-9333. Sean, there's a hearing going on, I guess, even as we speak up on the Hill with the Congressman Ross of Florida. What's that about?
Well, this is titled, I think, something to the effect of strengthening the federal retirement system. And what it's looking at, as we understand it from Congressman Ross, is essentially eliminating the federal employees' retirement system in favor of something like a, you know, that's, of course, a defined benefit program where you serve a certain amount of years, you know what your pension's going to be, And Congressman Wallace Ross wants to look at essentially substituting a 401k type program for that. Now, of course, the federal government already has a 401k program. It's called the Thrift Savings Plan. So I don't know. We don't know, and presumably the hearing will elaborate on this, exactly how what he's proposing would piggyback on top of what already exists. But you know, the significant thing is that this is intended to explore, essentially getting rid of the status quo as federal employees have known it for decades.
So no more benefit from the government, from the civil service side of government, indexed inflation. Yeah, that's a major
situation. My opinion on that, Mike, is,
sure.
I think that's the answer.
What's that?
I think that's the answer to, we wouldn't have to worry about a high 3 to high 5. We wouldn't have to worry about raising the retirement age. We wouldn't have to change anything in the current system. And that means not upsetting current voters who wouldn't like it if you took away their supplement or changed their retirement calculation. Then you would have the situation with kids coming out of college saying, do I want to go work for the government who doesn't have a pension, or do I want to go work in private industry who also doesn't have a pension? So I think politically that would be the safest way to go.
Wow, this could put us out of business. We thrive on problems.
Well, I always said once they don't need me anymore, that's when I'll retire.
Well, I have to say before before anyone gets upset, I mean, this is just an idea. And also one thing that's not clear, and again, I assume this will come up at the hearing, is whether this, you know, whether people already in FERS would be grandfathered in, whether this would just apply to people coming, assuming we're ever enacted, which isn't likely anytime soon, I would say, whether people coming in, it would only affect people joining, entering federal service as opposed to those who are already there.
What I heard floated about that a couple weeks ago when this first idea came about was that they were going to try to make it for people hired after a certain date, and I think the year I heard was after 2013. So I can't imagine they would take away the benefits of people currently in the government, but of course, never say never.
Right, and then that could reverse your theory about people staying longer. If something like this happened, they would all bail out December 31st, 2012.
Mass exodus.
Again, you never know about these things. And Sean's right to point out that this is just a gleam in the congressman's eye right now. But he's an important guy. He's a very smart fellow, and I thought it was interesting the way they phrase it as strengthening the civil service retirement system, and you think, strengthening it for whom? Taxpayers, maybe. The beneficiaries, not so much. Let me go on here. Tammy, one of the things that NARF and other people have pointed out, they think a much greater danger to people than the high 3 to high 5 is this one that would adopt the chained cost of living adjustment formula, and that is they would measure measure inflation each year using a different formula, and the end result would be that based on the system they use now, under this chained CPI system, they would come up with raises that were about 0.4 to 0.5% less than under the current system, and that over time this would devalue people's retirement.
Yeah, it would, and I guess over the years, I have an uncle who retired in 1978. At the time, they were giving two cost-of-living adjustments per year, and inflation was double-digit, and he's seen his retirement just about triple over the past 34 years. And then, of course, there was the change in the COLA just, you know, maybe 10 years ago or so, where they did change the measurement of inflation, which also resulted in a less generous COLA. So this isn't nothing new to have a threat to change the COLA, but the more you chip away at that inflation protection, the less comfortable people are going to be in their later years of retirement when their expenses for health care go up. And I think it is a big worry for current retirees that they may not be able to, you know, buy the same groceries and pay for the same insurance when they're in their 80s as they can when they retire in their 50s or 60s.
And the rationale behind this substituting the chain COLA for the Consumer Price Index, the CPIW, is that people, when times are tough, when inflation is low and that kind of thing, when people are getting less money, that they adjust their habits. You know, that you go from steak to hamburger, and you know, that kind of thing. And they're saying it's a more realistic way to measure inflation, particularly for older people who don't buy everything in that market basket of goods that the Labor Department uses each year, you know, refrigerators, tuition costs, and that sort of thing. So the proponents of this chain COLA say it's much more realistic, much fairer, and that it would save the government a tremendous amount of money over a short haul.
I think as long as there is a COLA, I think we're still good, because in a lot of private sector pensions, there is no guaranteed COLA, which, you know, does chip away at the buying power of those dollars over years.
I remember a very competent lobbyist for NARF, the National Active and Retired Federal Employees, one time said, she said, every year we can delay any damage to the COLA is a major victory for our people. And they have delayed it, since you pointed out, since they dropped the idea of giving two COLAs a year, there hasn't been any damage done to the COLA system, the inflation adjusting system. And that's been money in the bank for federal workers and retirees.
Well, let me tell you one little quick story about a friend of mine who just retired December 31st this year, or last year, I guess it is. And she could have retired a year ago, my friend Georgia. So she worked the extra year, which meant her retirement did go up. And it went up pretty significant, about $250 a month for staying on that extra year. But then I told her, I said, Georgia, if you would have retired September of 2010 instead of December of 2011, your COLA that you would have gotten, that 3.6% that retirees got on January 1st, would have actually increased her retirement $337 a month. So working that extra year, she actually lost about $85 a month.
Interesting, yeah, yeah.
That's how important the COLA is.
Well, and it, you know, a lot of this, too, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think a lot of it is how you look at it, because it would indeed, she would have had a larger annuity if she'd done that, but she was also getting a paycheck every 2 weeks from the...
Yeah, a lot of things to factor into that, aside from the fact she really liked her job.
Yeah, yeah, and well, I think that it comes down to that, and if you can't stand the commute, if you can't stand the traffic, or your coworkers or your boss, then you know by all means bail out. But you rarely make money by retiring. The longer you work, the more you make, right?
Yeah. And the other good news for her is she did hear from OPM yesterday. She's just retired less than 4 weeks ago, so that's good news.
Oh, can we say what agency she was with?
Yeah, she was with State Department.
State Department, okay. And they, I think you sent me an email. You said they had assigned her a case number, which is a very good sign. Huh?
That's right. She should be getting her interim check, hopefully, on February 1st.
Now, these interim checks, I've heard anecdotally, people have told me, I haven't seen one, that they can range from as much as 80 to even 90% in your friend's case, as she hopes, to as low as 40%. Is that? Is that what you've heard?
I've seen. In fact, I talked to a postal employee the other day who retired a year ago and who's getting $15 a month, which tells me there's a problem with his case. That is not the norm. But I mean, there are times when OPM will look at a retirement case, and if they can't see that that employee is either qualified to retire based on the documentation, or if there's something missing, they have to take that into consideration. So some of it's up to the agency to make sure they send a complete package for that employee when they retire.
I'm not trying to be flip here, but is that $15 a month net or gross?
I guess that's it. Oh, that's what he takes to the bank.
I don't know how they do it. Well, you know, there again, maybe it's a time to remind people the Susie Orman rule and the others is that have 8 months, a year possible of money. Francis Rose puts it as pay your expenses, but living expenses, which would include rent, mortgage, Pepco, that sort of thing, because you could get into a nightmarish situation like this, your postal employee who has been getting $15 a month for a year. That's amazing.
Crazy.
I don't know how they do it. I mean, maybe we ought to find out if this is the geezer bandit.
Luckily this guy did go on to a second career, which is why he's not creating such a fuss about it. He's like, I'm sure they'll eventually pay me.
Very well. Well, he will get a nice retroactive check. We hope he's alive to cash it.
There you go.
Tammy, Sean's eyes lit up when I mentioned the best day to retire, because this is we always hear a lot about this. How did you come up with this concept? And I know it's... We always stress that there's no one best day to retire for anybody. We typically think of December 31st to January 3rd, although this year it was different. But what do you mean by best day to retire?
Well, that's a good question, because a lot of people I meet people who say, I'm going to retire at the end of the year. And I said, why are you picking the end of the year? And they said, well, you know, it's the magic date. You know, Mike Causey says it's the magic date. I was like, well, do you have a reason? No, it's just the magic date. But the reason why, you know, we've always said the end of the year is a good time to retire dates back to the 1980s when I was working in the benefits office at the FBI. And we used to encourage our employees to wait till the end of the year, because that allowed them, and still true today, to save up your annual leave before you hit that use or lose deadline, so that you can actually carry over leave from your previous year, 240 for most employees, and then the last year that you work, assuming you're in the 8-hour category, you can save up another 208 hours. So by the time you retire on either December 31st or January 3rd for CSRS, you might have a balance of 448 hours of leave, assuming you didn't take any, and then you get paid for that. And the whole purpose of encouraging that was because we knew it was going to take a while to get those first retirement checks started, and we wanted our employees to have a little slush fund so they didn't have to take money out of savings or, you know, go back to work right away in order to be able to pay their bills.
Tammy, let me interrupt you for a second. Mm-hmm. Slush fund, love it. But we need to take a short break. We'll be right back here on WFED.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied, but today GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said, it's a thought, but Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com. Then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Join Jim Fleisig on Thursday, February 2nd at 12 noon for his monthly series, The Federal Executive Forum. The program will focus on critical issues facing government and industry leaders in securing cyberspace. The panel includes government leaders from DHS, U.S. Cyber Command, and OSD. Don't miss The Federal Executive Forum, Thursday, February 2nd at 12 noon, here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and online at federalnewsradio.com. Sponsored by Lockheed Martin and McAfee.
Arming your home security system gives you peace of mind, but are you paying $30, $40, $50 or more in monitoring fees? Switch to Ackerman Security Systems, the metro area's most trusted name in security, and pay just $18.95 a month. That's right, $18.95 a month, and no cost to switch. Don't have a system? Then Ackerman offers the latest technology, including wireless monitoring. Call by Wednesday and get 3 months of basic monitoring free when you switch or start service with Ackerman. Call 888-999-1070, AckermanSecurity.com.
The Federal IT Challenge is a series exploring the administration's aim to fundamentally change how the federal government purchases and uses IT, and a discussion around one of the biggest goals, reducing the number of federal data centers by at least 40% by 2015. During the show, Doug Bourgeois, Vice President and Federal Chief Cloud Executive for VMware, commented.
Platform as a service is a critical layer in the cloud stack. Infrastructure as a service was only the first step towards the cloud. The platform enables agencies to develop, deploy, and use applications in more agile ways. It allows them to accelerate their time to value for mission applications and continue the savings journeys that they've already begun with their journey to infrastructure as a service in this difficult, constraining budget environment.
To hear the Federal IT Challenge in its entirety and learn more about the journey to cloud computing, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword VMware. That's federalnewsradio.com, keyword VMware.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on Federal News Radio at 10 a.m. This week, my special guest is Dr. Alan Dappin, founder of DocTalker.com, a unique healthcare delivery model. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman & Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia. Visit us on the web at OFPlaw.com.
When you get a vaccination, it takes time for your body to make the antibodies that protect you from a threat. Now scientists are engineering instant immunity. You'd still need a shot, but maybe just once in your life. Carlos Barbas, a Scripps Institute researcher, says his vaccine produces antibodies that find and attach to a certain chemical which can be engineered into a variety of oral drugs, allowing an antibody escort to their target.
Once you've taken that pill, you ideally obtain this instant immunity to that pathogen or to that disease.
Barbas says the antibody-drug combo could seek out germs, cancers, even poisons, and that once the attack is over, your body makes more antibodies to wait for a new medicine.
Ideally, you're immune for life and have these universal circulating antibodies that can be programmed on the fly.
The technique is several years away from trial in humans. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey talking with Sean Riley, from the senior writer from the Federal Times, and Tammy Flanagan, a senior benefits person with the National Institutes of Transition Planning, former FBI employee, and probably knows the government benefits world better than any of us, maybe all of us put together. Tammy, before the break, you were talking about the best day to retire and the reason why at the FBI back in the day you used to recommend people retire at the end of the year in that magic period, December 31 to January 3rd, and the reason was, and this is big bucks, and you discovered this concept. It's possible for a person to carry over, I think you said, 448 hours of annual leave into the new year. If
well,
there's
240 plus save up the 208.
Correct. Yeah, don't take a vacation.
Right.
And then you have all this. You have 400 hours at your salary level, and if there happens to be a pay raise in that January, you get most of that annual leave is paid at the higher rate. So this, for somebody up in the GS 13s and 14s and 15 level, that's a chunk of change.
It's like design your own buyout.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. Okay. But that was one thing. And then the other thing, depending on whatever time of the year you want to retire, not everybody wants to wait till the end of December. So in any given month, whether we're looking at February or looking at June, I always start with the end of the month, because in most cases, your retirement's going to start the first day of the month after you retire. So in other words, if I pick, let's say, February 7th to retire, then my salary would only be paid through February 7th, but my first retirement check wouldn't be for the month of March. So I don't want to go from the 8th to the 29th of February with no money. So I might work until the end of February so I can get paid for that month and then get a retirement check for March. But with the civil service system and not FERS, you have a 3-day grace period at the beginning of every month. So I could retire March 1st, 2nd, or 3rd, and I would still get a March retirement check even though I retired into that month. So the CSRS folks can look at the week that they're going to retire, and if, let's say, the Thursday is the last day of the month, Friday's the first of the month, and it's the end of the leave period, then you might want to wait till the first of the month so you can get that leave accumulation and get a full paycheck and then still get a retirement check for that month.
It's interesting. I think most people don't fine-tune it as much and aren't aware of it, but there are people, and I know you've had more of them come to you than I have to me, but there are people who worry about retiring like on January 1st because they want to get that holiday pay.
Yeah, that's true, too. Sometimes you can get that last little holiday in there before you leave the front door. I remember one time, Mike, you told me when you'd meet employees back in the day that sometimes they would say, "Hi, I'm John Smith, and I can retire in 1 year, 5 months, and 22 days."
Exactly,
because,
exactly.
We do look at that, for those years leading up to retirement, because we know it's coming, and we kind of target a date.
Right. Well, someone you and I both know, back when he was still working for the government, he was anxious to get out, and he had boiled it down to the number of oil changes. And he'd say, "I'm 12 oil changes away from it," or 10, 9, 8. And boy, on the last oil change, he did pull the plug, got out of there.
Yeah.
Tammy, anything more about the? Oh, I know. Normally, when we're telling people who want to retire at the end of the year and who want to take advantage of this this extra money they can get with their extra amount of annual leave, also it throws it into a new tax year,
which is
beneficial to them. Typically, we tell people and under FERS to retire December 31st, and people under the civil service retirement system to go out the 1st, 2nd, or more likely the 3rd. But that wasn't the case this year, was it?
Yeah, the only reason why that was different this year is because the leave year actually ended at the end of the calendar year, which doesn't always happen. The end of this year, January, or the 2012 leave year, actually will end in January, mid-January of 2013. So for employees planning a 2012 retirement, and if they want to stay till the end of the year, a civil service employee might actually choose to retire January 3rd of 2013, and they would still get to accumulate all their leave, get paid for the leave, and still be paid their salary through January 3rd. So this will be one of those normal years where we say FERS people December 31st, and CSRS people could wait till January 3rd if they want to and still take advantage of the leave accrual.
Sean, I'm learning a lot about this.
Absolutely.
Sean is shaking his head in awe here. So thank you so much. Sean, if you had to do a crystal ball, and I hate it when people ask me this, but this committee that's dealing with the civil service matters now, the way to find money to extend the payroll tax. Would you have any predictions as to what they might come up with? And Tammy, I ask you the same thing.
I would have to say, I mean, they've got, as you noted, until the end of next month to come to some agreement to extend the payroll tax cut and also to extend unemployment insurance and come up with the so-called doc fix, which is essentially ensuring that physicians participating in Medicare don't take a big hit to their reimbursements. I'd have to assume, there are a number of proposals that would affect federal pay and benefits that are on the table, and I'd have to assume that probably some of them will, assuming there is a final bill, some of those will find their way into the mix. You know, going back to Congressman Ross's hearing, as I said, I don't think there's going to be any immediate threat to the current defined benefit pension programs in the federal government. But what it does, I think, is sort of shift the center of political gravity. And if to the extent that it makes other proposals, increasing the employee contribution rate to FERS, look a little more palatable, a little more moderate. I mean, you're not talking about getting rid of the program. You're just asking federal employees to pay a little bit more. And let's not forget that in its recommendations to the so-called supercommittee last September, the Obama administration proposed increasing the FERS contribution rate by about, I think it was a total of 1.2% over 3 years. So there is bipartisan support for some of this. And I would assume something like that might go through. The high three to high five was already talked about, has been on the table for quite a while now. A lot of, like water going downhill, these proposals tend to follow the path of least resistance, and this may be one area in which members of the conference committee think they can find agreement a little more easily than on some other issues.
Tammy, you got any thoughts on that?
Well, the only thing I'll say is that whenever people ask me this, usually first thing when I come in to teach a seminar, and I'll read them a memo that came out from the Department of Air Force to all the employees outlining these possible changes, all the things you've just listed. And then I'll tell them at the end of my read that this memo was dated in the Reagan administration.
Always good to have some context.
A lot of these things have been threatened over the years. And looking back over the 25 years I've been watching this, most of the changes, and as Sean said, the path of least resistance, because most of the changes I've seen that really do impact federal employees have been improvements.
Yeah, that's right. They went from the high five to the high three.
And, that's right.
And 2009 was arguably the best year on Capitol Hill that federal workers have ever had. A huge number of benefits were
added
approved.
Sick leave defers, changed the redeposit rules. Yeah, there was a lot of improvements that year.
Yeah.
Nothing taken away.
Well, it seems to me a lot of people are saying they're going to have to do something because this is an election year. And I would be a contrarian and say maybe they don't want to do anything because this is an election year. And if you look at President Obama's Affordable Care Act, the law, so many of those provisions were not effective for a year or two or three, and the same with this. So we're getting a break signal here. Be right back.
Meeting mission goals through health, brought to you by General Dynamics IT.
A new study of the benefits of electronic health records finds some early anecdotal evidence of major savings. The analysis by Bloomberg Government examined early EHR adopters like the Veterans Health Administration, which realized more than $3 billion in net benefits over 10 years, and Sentara Healthcare, which achieved a $50 million annual return on the investment in their EHR system. And the University of Pittsburgh Children's Hospital cut its serious medication errors by 92%.
General Dynamics IT is meeting the challenges of a complex healthcare environment that requires far-reaching experience and full-spectrum capabilities. Government, military, and commercial health payer organizations rely on General Dynamics IT's health services, solutions, and support to tackle their toughest issues. General Dynamics IT's broad understanding of healthcare data, military health missions, fraud, waste, and abuse protection, and more ensures support and innovation tailored to your real-world needs. Today's healthcare challenges are formidable. To learn more, go to GDIT.com.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Facero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, nutrition, dietary supplements, herbal remedies, and more. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources at myvillagegreen.com. Visit Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda at 5415 West Cedar Lane.
Experience GW Basketball in one of D.C.'s best college venues, the Colonials Club. As a member of the Colonials Club, you will enjoy a game day atmosphere that is unmatched in Washington-area college basketball. Your philanthropic donation and loyal support for GW Athletics provides countless opportunities to our student-athletes in pursuit of both their academic and athletic goals. Call 202-994-7325 to join the Colonials Club today and help raise high the Buff and Blue.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit. Presented by NITP has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering it. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to GEICO.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Headed to Fort Detrick or the I-270 Technology Corridor, Federal News Radio can be heard crystal clear on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. It's the same great station, just on an added frequency. Get the latest news about the federal government and government contractors. Hear exclusive interviews with the movers and shakers in the federal arena. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
Welcome back to Your Turn. The Mike Causey. I'm talking with Tammy Flanagan. She's the senior benefits person for the National Institutes of Transition Planning and the discoverer of the best day to retire, which is one of the most popular subjects on our beat. And Sean Riley, senior writer for the Federal Times. And we've been sort of covering the waterfront here. Tammy, we were going through what do you think might happen, might come out of the Congress this year?
You mean as far as negative changes?
As far as these things, you know, the horror show, the various lists that we've been looking at, including the proposals that are in the before this joint conference committee.
I would think the easiest things to actually get approval and not upset too many people, because I think we see it coming, might be an increase to the contribution to retirement, possibly that change to the COLA. But like you said, that would upset, you know, every one of the retirees. So I don't know. I think being an election year, I really think there's going to be very few of those changes enacted, would be my prediction.
That changing the COLA to reduce future raises is so complicated. It's a hard concept to grasp.
That's why I think it might happen, because
yeah,
it's hard to understand. Nobody understands.
Exactly. You can't mobilize opposition because nobody gets it. Yeah. We're talking during the break about the Postal Service. There are a couple of things brewing there, and it's none of them are particularly good for the workers. One is that they've hit an impasse between the Postal Service itself and at least one of the unions, or is it more than one?
Actually, two. Mm-hmm. What happened last Friday, the Postal Service, of course, it has four major employee unions. It's currently attempting to negotiate contracts with two of them, the National Association of Letter Carriers and the National Postal Mail Handlers Union. Both their contracts, the previous contracts, essentially expired in November, but all sides have agreed to continue the terms of those contracts while they're trying to negotiate new agreements. But in any case, on Friday it was announced that they've formally reached an impasse. That means that it will go possibly to negotiation, to mediation rather, but then more likely to binding arbitration. And also, both the unions and the Postal Service really aren't saying very much about what the causes were of this impasse, but the National Association of Letter Carriers claims it was the Postal Service in this case that this declined to extend contract talks and thus is pushing things in the direction of binding arbitration. That's interesting because in the past, the Postal Service has essentially claimed that the arbitration process is skewed against it because the arbitrator is not required, according to the Postal Service, to take the economic condition of the Postal Service into account and thus wouldn't necessarily have to acknowledge that the Postal Service is losing billions of dollars, can't afford to hand out raises, that kind of thing. So if that is the case, that the Postal Service has decided essentially in negotiations lead in the direction of binding arbitration, it would seem to indicate that they're hoping to get a better deal out of arbitration, maybe a quicker deal in terms of cutting labor costs than they might if they try to negotiate a new contract.
Well, I point out, too, that these two unions, the letter carriers, are the people, the men and women who stick the mail in your mailbox. They're, mm-hmm. They're the outside. The mail handlers tend to work inside or on loading docks, but literally handling the mail. And then there's another union, the American Postal Workers Union, which is predominantly inside. These are the clerks, the window clerks you deal with. Now, what's happened with the APWU?
Well, they are the Postal Service did reach an agreement with them in a contract that was ratified last May. It'll go through May of 2015, and the Postal Service claimed that, as I recall, it'll save about $3 billion over what they would have paid under the prior contract. And one of the most significant features is that it establishes a two-tier wage system, where new workers will basically be under a different wage scale that will pay them less than older workers would make. And as I understand it, the Postal Service is seeking something similar from other unions in the negotiation process.
The Postal Service also pays by contractual agreement. It also pays a much larger share of the employee health premiums than do other federal agencies. It doesn't apply to retirees, but it does apply to workers. And they're talking at one point. The Postmaster General was talking about setting up his own health plan. Tammy, had you dealt with that?
I've heard about it. I don't know what the status is, though. I think that I agree with some of the people who say that would be detrimental to the entire FEHB because you're taking a big portion of the participants out of it. So I hope it doesn't happen.
I don't think they proposed this a few months ago. It hasn't gone anywhere. The Obama administration's skeptical. The unions, of course, are opposed. And the Postal Service really hasn't provided much information on exactly how they would go about creating, essentially an entirely new health plan for hundreds of thousands of employees, particularly given that, postal workers tend to suffer, higher injury rates and are a large component of the FEHBP.
Yeah, it's one of the most industrialized operations the federal government has. I mean, you're talking about conveyor belts and pulleys and things along. You're talking about people being in a vehicle for 6 hours a day, which is the most dangerous part of police work, more so than the crook part itself. And the dog bites that we all make fun of, and they're features of cartoons, but they are not funny and can be very serious. So the Postal Service at one point I read it had a higher injury rate than the Marine Corps, at least in peacetime.
Yeah, the other thing I'd worry about, too, if they came out of the federal health plan is that they sponsor two of the programs, the mail handlers benefit program and the letter carriers health benefit program. So would that mean that they would leave as well And I think a lot of employees who don't work for the Postal Service are in those plans.
That's right. That's a good point. And the American Postal Workers Union also has
that's right. There's
so there's at least three, maybe more that we're not thinking of. But, yeah, that's a good – anytime you start removing people from a risk pool, again, the law of unintended consequences comes into play. But, yeah, would federal workers who belong to those health plans be able to remain in them?
Yeah, and that's another, that's simply that, those are questions the Postal Service, at least to my knowledge, has not answered. They haven't done so publicly. And, you know, their main rationale is it would save, I think, they say would save 7 to 10% on their current insurance premiums.
Walton Francis, who is, probably the world's leading authority on the federal health program, said, on this program a couple of times, he thinks it's a terrible idea for the employees and for the program. Now, what about the incredible shrinking Postal Service? It's down, 250,000 people since, was it 2006?
Yeah, that's what Representative Darrell Issa, who chairs the House Oversight Committee, which ultimately has a lot of oversight responsibility for the Postal Service, said recently. Now, that includes, we should note, that includes both, if I'm reading his numbers right, it includes both career and non-career. And now, Congressman Issa says he needs to come down another 250,000, 260,000 in the next couple of years. The Postal Service wants to take the numbers down, I think, just career, just down to 400,000. So that would be a drop around 150,000 in the career workforce, and then, you know, an additional perhaps 100,000 in the non-career workforce. So it's getting smaller. The question is how fast.
Yeah, and how they do it. If people retire and they do it via attrition, it's one thing. If they actually get to layoffs, you know, you're talking about increasing unemployment at a time when that's the last thing the country needs.
Well, as you recall, the Postal Service last year actually is part of the same agenda that would take them out of the federal employees' health benefits program also proposed wants to get legislative authority from Congress to be able to essentially breach union contracts and lay off employees. You know, they say they've been working as hard as they can to reduce the workforce through attrition. It's just not, you know, it's just not happening fast enough, and they need the same kind of freedom that private employers do. But as you noted, Mike, I mean, with the current, it's a huge employer as it is. And given the current economic environment, there's a lot of resistance in Congress, and not, I think, just from Democrats, to giving them this kind of latitude.
Yeah. Tammy, you've got about a minute left. Do you have any final thoughts?
Well, just so this all reminds me of the steel industry in the 1970s.
Uh-huh.
The unions got involved, and pay wages went way up 37%, but then in 1981, none of them had a job.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the Postmaster General has pointed out that there are a large number of post offices that cost twice as much to operate or even more than the revenue they bring in, and they're really just there to satisfy the community, you know, a place for a letter drop and to meet and greet people.
Unfortunately, technology, I think, has taken away some of the need for some of the services we had in the past.
Well, and the Postal Service, in a sense, if you go back, was almost set up to fail because it was before the technology and it was before FedEx and UPS or else they were just fledgling operations. But they can skim the cream, and the Postal Service still has to take a letter from Washington, D.C. to Nome, Alaska for 44 cents. So last word, I guess, to me. Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Tammy. Thanks for being with us. And remember, our show is archived. You can listen anytime. We'll see you next Wednesday. Have a good week.